My name is Jody Kretzmann, and this is a series this week on that I'm calling Social Justice in the City, touching on a number of different aspects, none of which I think we're going to go into in too much depth this week, but a number of different aspects of what's going on, in my view anyway, in contemporary American cities, both the problems and the promises, and what relationship those problems and promises might have to us, particularly as they pertain to and as we are interested in thinking together about the questions of social justice. We started the other day doing it with a rather broad brush, and I think we'll continue to do that so that one doesn't have to be a technical economist or political scientist or sociologist to enter into these discussions. It's clear to me that in my own experience in cities don't come easily divided into disciplines. They are not easily perceived as simply politics or simply economics or simply sociology. So that there's something artificial in doing that to a series on cities, but I'm doing it anyway this week, partly just as a way to center our attention on one door into examining urban reality, not necessarily to argue at all that any of these particular categories, particularly of the social sciences, are more explanatory than any other. I mentioned, and I probably should again, a little bit of my own background and bias in this area. I've been teaching about and writing about and acting in cities, in particular Chicago, for about the last 18 years of my life, which makes me sort of humble about it. It makes me aware of how vast and various the topic is and how many different directions we could go in. It makes me particularly aware of how little I know about cities in a global sense. Although I have spent some time in cities outside the United States and studied them a bit, I really am concentrating this week our discussion on United States cities and their peculiar problems. And even more than that, I'm narrowing at least the beginnings of most of my remarks to cities in what we call the Frost Belt, the older industrial cities of the United States, from about Minneapolis, Chicago, St. Louis, back east. Those cities have some peculiar kinds of characteristics in common, and they also have some, I'm finding out more and more these days, and they have a lot of characteristics in common with some Western cities and some Sunbelt cities, just that I don't know the Seattles and Portlands quite as well as I do those so-called out here anyway, back east cities. So that's a boundary about me that you should know about. And I am finally, and I have to continue to confess this, an absolute lover of cities. I love virtually everything about them, including their diversity and their pace and the way in which multiplicity of events interact with each other in often really confusing ways. I find that immensely stimulating and something to celebrate rather than to escape. So you have to take that into consideration when you listen to me, too. The final thing I might say in introduction, and it'll be very clear, I think, in the discussion today, is that although I don't have a particular, I decided this week not to have a particular session on cities and race. Race is going to, it plays an absolutely central role in understanding what the dynamics are in our cities these days. So that what I have been doing and will continue to do is to play with the dynamics of race in the United States as a central part of the dynamics of urban stuff in the United States as it plays out in the economics and the politics and the social and cultural life and so on of our cities. And it's certainly going to play a big part, at least in my introductory remarks today. So today's emphasis really is on the political life in cities, recent political life in cities. I might remind you that at the last session, I build the political session as, from my point of view, containing some glimmers of hope. Hope in relationship to what I tried to define the other day as the major, at least from the point of view of social justice, the major problematic area of cities today. and that is the economic life of cities today. I tried to just to bring a few of you up to date to lay out on Monday the recent economic sort of macro trends in cities. We talked about the massive, what's called deindustrialization of the older industrial cities, the phasing out of the industrial phase of those cities, the closing of scores and scores of huge factories, the replacement really of the heavy manufacturing industries with service industries. We talked about the two trends in cities these days being the simultaneous growth on the one hand of glittering, wonderfully beautiful downtown areas in city after city. It's true in Manhattan, it's true in Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, even in some cities that have had more problems than those. Glittering downtowns, headquarters for service industries, headquarters for new communications industries, basically pushing paper and communicating with each other through satellites and computers and all of the modern kinds of stuff. Also being magnets for culture and tourists and so forth. That growing up at the same time as, clearly, in the last 15 years, we're witnessing also the growth of a seemingly intractable underclass. The numbers, the absolute numbers of poor people, particularly in the last 8 years, have been growing, and so it seems have been the numbers of those poor people who are no longer able to step over the line into some kind of a working class identity therefore have some kind of mobility to their lives. That is what has become known in the last few years as the urban underclass. We talked a little bit about some of the characteristics of that underclass. I'll be talking a little bit about that, more about that tomorrow. But the economic analysis we dealt with very briefly on Monday had to do with the mismatch between those gleaming downtowns and that group of people, the underclass. Right? And the analysis problem basically was that, unlike previous groups of poor people and immigrants into cities who had a first rung of the ladder to step onto, a first rung which required very little skill, only a willingness to work, and then would lead to a second rung and so on, but that first rung is no longer there. The requirements of the jobs and the requirements of the skills that the new downtowns contain are such that they call for training and capacities that are just not there in the new underclass. So what we have, in fact, are neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood in cities that are, for all intents and purposes, cut off from the mainstream economy, disconnected. Communities, disconnected people, and therefore the growth of an alternative economy, some of which is non-legal, some of which is quite legal, but just off the record. So that's what we talked about in terms of the economic problem that seems to me to define the basic social justice issue in cities. Is that clear? That's an economic definition of the problem. There are lots of other elements, it seems to me, that play into them. One of them, clearly, is also racism, the continuing virulence of racial discrimination in the United States, which you see over and over and over again in cities particularly, but more subtly in other parts of our nation as well. So I have said, then, that if that's the problematic, that we need to begin to look for sources of possible change in the direction, at least, of social justice elsewhere. I don't see it in the economic system at this point. There's nothing that allows me to believe that allowing the private sector market forces to continue to work will do anything but increase the urban underclass in absolute numbers and in its isolation from the mainstream economy. All, however, is not bleak. It seems to me, anyway, from my perspective, that there are interesting stirrings in the political life of cities, and I want to just spend a few minutes on that, and then we can talk about it some more. Let me do two major things with you in the next few minutes. First, let me just talk briefly about what lots of people have been calling in the last couple of years a new black awakening in politics that is centered on city governments in the United States. And secondly, then, to fill in the beginnings of an outline that I put on the board here that we've been playing with in Chicago a little bit, some colleagues and I, about forms of city politics, forms of city government, and a possible new formation of city government that's city government and politics that seems to be at least potentially emerging in the last couple of years in some cities. Okay. We should remind ourselves of the national context within which the explosion of black elected officials in particular, let me deal mostly with black elected officials here, but be aware also that we have seen a parallel, though not nearly as large, growth in the number of Hispanic elected officials too in San Antonio and Texas and Southwest cities particularly, but even in some non-Southwest areas of the nation. But let me mostly concentrate on the black phenomena here. It's interesting that this is happening in a period where all of the reports and statistics indicate that the relative condition of black people in the United States is worsening. Right? Since 1979, the gap between black incomes and white family incomes has steadily broadened once again. From 65 to 79, actually from 65 to 74, that gap narrowed between black and white incomes. From 74 to 79, kind of stagnated. And then from 79 to the present, it's been expanding once again. That is, the position relative to whites of black people in the United States, by that measure, which is probably the best overall measure, though it has some problems with it, is worsening, clearly. At the same time, that is not just a racial phenomenon. That is, that the absolute numbers of poor people since 1980 have been growing. And in fact, the phenomenon that exacerbates the problem of the urban underclass has been growing, and that is the separation within the black community of a still growing, or at least not shrinking, it's not clear what's going on since 83 here, a not shrinking black middle class, the separation of a black middle class from a black underclass, spatially, right, into cities. That too has been going on. And all of this in the context where, at least since 1979, minority peoples in the United States, and particularly blacks, have had absolutely no clout on the national level. It is almost impossible for a national black leader to get an audience in the White House. I'm sure you're all aware of that. There are a few blacks around in the Reagan administration, but they are they tend to be blacks with a free enterprise kind of economics to them, which is fine. But I think more important to me, they are black folks with no constituency in the black community and no following. They are clearly in some way, whatever we mean by tokens, they're that in the Reagan White House. And they also tend, in fact, to be apologists for particularly Reagan's economic programs. In the main, then, the black organizations in the United States, the major ones, have had absolutely no voice on the national level. The sole exception to the national, to the black, the lack of black presence, declining black presence in the last 8 years on the national level, obviously has been the phenomenon of Jesse Jackson. And we might want to talk about that a little bit. I've worked with Reverend Jackson some. It is an interesting sidetrack that we may want to get into in discussion. But clearly something that is new and generated out of the energy of the black community, and to some degree it's something I would argue that's generated out of the energy that has been growing in cities and is not disconnected from the main thing that I want to talk about. So that's a bleak context I'm laying out here. From the point of view of the black community in the United States. At the same time, then, it's amazing that from a situation where in 1981, slightly over 100 cities in the United States had black elected officials at the head of them, black mayors. We now have close to 600 black mayors in as of the fall of 1985. So an almost 600% rise in the number of black mayors. And a that is a higher rise, but not too much higher than an equally impressive rise in the number of black elected officials overall. In other words, black political power seems aimed at taking over the mayoralties of the cities, but not exclusively that way. There's an awful lot of activity at state and local levels throughout the United States. This has been called a major black political awakening, a kind of second phase of the 1960s civil rights movement, or third phase, if you sort of think about the black power phase as the second phase. And it's centered in the cities. Let me say a few things about those. Those over 500 mayors seem to me clearly not to represent the same story repeated 500 times. There are a lot of different stories in those 500 elections, and there are things, there are interesting things to learn about the state of the black community in particular, and the questions of social justice as they apply to race in the United States from those stories. Let me concentrate on major patterns in major cities, not the little towns at this point. A lot of those 500 are really small southern towns, right? But clearly, increasingly, we've got big cities to deal with here. We've got not only Newark, Gary, Detroit, but we've got Philadelphia and Chicago and Los Angeles and what am I missing? Atlanta, Birmingham, cities across regions, San Antonio with Cisneros and so on, across regions with lots of different characteristics. Let me identify three patterns that I think might pertain at least to the major cities here, and just think out loud with you in as simple a language as I can about these. If we are interested in black mayors representing black constituencies actually making a difference in the direction of social justice in a city, it seems to me we have to ask questions about the will and values of the people being elected, running for office and being elected. It's almost an ideological set of questions. And we have to ask questions about the resources available to those elected officials once they get elected, okay? So questions about the people themselves and about the resources available, and that is about the cities that they get elected in. A couple of different patterns here. The first wave of black mayors in major cities that were elected, I would argue, as people with strong civil rights values, strong will to advance their people, to advance causes of social justice, but were elected in contexts with absolutely no resources. Absolutely no resources. The classic cases here are Newark and Gary, right, where a city is almost abandoned by white people, where almost all of the industry has fled, where U.S. Steel in Gary is about to go, where virtually all of the heavy industry in Newark is outside Newark by the time that Ken Gibson inherits the mayoralty in Newark and Dick Hatcher inherits the mayoralty in Gary. Almost the same story applies to Detroit, it seems to me, where you've got a one-industry town with all three of the major auto makers out of the city by the time a black mayor inherits political power. So you almost got a situation where the whites have said, this city is no longer worth having, right? There's nothing here that's worth controlling. It's not a prize that's worth fighting for. Now, in fact, there were huge fights in all of those cities to keep black mayors from coming to power. But it's absolutely clear that once they got there, they didn't have very much to work with. And it's not very clear, it's not very clear that they've been able, in, for instance, the Newark and Gary and Detroit cases, to do much more than initiate a holding action for the people who were left in those abandoned cities. Right? So that's one set of experiences. It really started in the late 60s and continued through the 70s. The most devastated cities in the nation are almost, I mean, you can, it's an equation, right? You can just expect, if you see a city that has been totally deindustrialized and where white flight has happened in full throttle, you know that that's going to have a mayor that's black. The second kind of pattern, it seems to me, is a little bit more recent and a little bit more problematic because the dynamics of race are a little bit more difficult to discern. And that's a pattern where it seems to me the cities involved still have, to some considerable degree, the economic and class mix of people, as well as the job infrastructure there. There's some, in other words, considerable resources left in the city. They elect a black mayor anyway, but they elect as a black mayor a person who runs colorblind, let's put it that way, who does not run as a consciously black candidate, appealing to a black constituency, who runs as fundamentally a technician, a political technician, a governmental technician. The two best examples of that, it seems to me, are Philadelphia and Los Angeles, with Green in Philadelphia and Bradley in Los Angeles, where black mayors were able to be elected with some white support ignoring the issue of race. I'm absolutely convinced that, and I think Los Angeles is probably the ultimate case, I'm absolutely convinced that racial dynamics were and are absolutely central to what's going on in Los Angeles. And I'm uncomfortable with a politics that involves race in the United States and doesn't talk about it. I've talked to people up here who are from Los Angeles who swear to me that race doesn't play any part in the election of their black mayor. Everything I know about life in the United States tells me that that's probably not true, but that there is something about the presentation of certain kinds of candidates, and I think Bradley's probably the best example, but Green in Philadelphia, until the problems with that he's had with the bombing of the MOVE people, was the same kind of guy. Bradley, ex-policeman, able to sell himself as a fiscally conservative administrator, able to sell himself as someone who was absolutely a colorblind and fair administrator, in the most sort of corporate mold, right? And Green the same way in Philadelphia. That's an interesting case. Those are interesting cases because although you have black mayors taking over cities with a good many resources in them, you if you look at those cities 2 and 3 years later, you can't see anything that's been done differently. And I can't tell in Philadelphia what difference Green has made. It's a little unfair because he's only been in 2 years now. But I certainly can't tell the few times I've been in Los Angeles and talking to people in Los Angeles whether Tom Bradley being there has made any difference at all, particularly for the poorer communities in Los Angeles. They don't think so, anyway. The leadership of those communities don't think so. Well, okay, that's pattern two. City with a lot of resources, but technicians who are black, elected. I think there are a couple of other cities that are beginning to look like it's a third pattern, and my own is one, Chicago is one. Atlanta may be another, although it's a little bit more problematic in Atlanta, it seems to me. Basically, you've got a combination there of cities that, although they've got lots and lots of problems, still are worth having. They're worth fighting over. They're not Newark's and Gary's. They've got a lot of resources. They're lively. They've got a lot of diversified job base, Atlanta and Chicago in particular. And for a variety of reasons, what happens in them is that they elect somebody like a Dick Hatcher or a Ken Gibson in Newark and Gary. In Chicago's case, it's Harold Washington. In Atlanta, it's been Maynard Jackson and Andy Young. So you've got, on the one hand, mayors who have, I think, the will and the values to try to do something with city government that actually affects poor people, and in particular tries to attack the problem of the underclass. And on the other hand, you've got settings to which they've been elected to govern that have the resources that allow maybe something to happen. So that's the third pattern, and for me, it's by far the most hopeful pattern. It hasn't happened often enough to really be able to tell whether there's enough of them to make a pattern. I'm not really sure yet, but at least I'm a little bit hopeful. Okay, let me back off the actual cities here, and we can come back to them in a minute. Just to fill in briefly, come at this from a totally different angle here for a second. When you think about city government and politics, there's a lot of different ways to think about it. I want to play with, just for a couple of minutes here, three types, which are two of which are classic types of city government, right, and politics, the machine and the reform type. And the third, which is something new, and which may be a carrier of social justice in some way that we haven't seen before. You all know about machines. We just finally got rid of ours in Chicago, or we're still getting rid of it or something. Most cities got rid of it in the early 19th or the early 20th century and replaced it with reform government. The thing about the machine, obviously, is that it works like the Soviet Union, right? That political party determines what the government looks like. You are rewarded in government, jobs are given to you in government based on your successful political performance. That's not unfamiliar to students of the Soviet Union, neither is it to the students of city government. In a machine kind of government, that the core value is loyalty. That is, above all, be loyal to the folks in the club. And in fact, if there's an organizational analog on the outside of politics to what a machine looks like, it's sort of the men's club, right? And it has been really the men's club. It's not just a social club. It's a fraternity. It's not a sorority. The major constituency for the machine types of government has always, in the history of the United States cities, been white ethnic groups. That is, machines have served from the East Coast all the way out to the West Coast as the major sort of stepping stone into public life, and then finally into private sector success for white ethnic immigrants in the United States. And the characteristic transaction of the machine is, as I'm sure most of you are aware, the deal. Right? Machines basically run on deals. In Chicago, we discovered when Mayor Washington took over the government that virtually nothing had been written down. That a huge city of over 3 million people, 45,000 employees, had been run on handshakes and pats on the back and winks. A variety of forms of the deal that I think were probably characteristic of virtually every city in the country until the early 20th century, and then gradually all cities, even finally including Chicago, have undergone something else. Most cities, there's a lot more we can say about that, but most cities got rid of a machine in favor of a reform style of government, right? That's what happened beginning in the early 20th century. In essence, what the reform style of government tries to do is to replace this horribly corrupt at times model of government with something that looks much more like the modern business corporation, right? So that the organizational analog, in fact, is the corporation. The core value for a reform government: efficiency. Efficiency and productivity. Not to say that it's always reached, but that's what the value is. The constituency of the reform government is basically the middle class. interestingly, often both black and white. These are people who are just in city after city sort of get fed up with working class corruption and decide to replace with some sort of professional model of corporate efficiency what they see as a very costly way of operating in the machine. And the characteristic transaction of a reform government is not the deal, but the plan. Like any self-respecting corporation, entering into the budget-making process and doing projections for the next 5 years, rationalizing the operation, moving from deals, which is sort of partly emotional, right, partly based on how we feel about each other, moving from that to something that's much more rationalized is what the reformers have been about. Now, this has some advantages to it, and it's, in fact, still the dominant mode of operating cities. Not that cities run whole that efficiently all the time or look that much like a corporation. But if you explore the sort of professional urban government people, this cluster of stuff is mostly what they're about. There may be something new emerging, and this brings us back to the sort of Atlanta-Chicago business. When we thought about, I was on the, wrote some of the major policy documents for Washington in his campaign and have served a lot of consultative functions in his administration. When we thought about what it is we're seeing in Chicago and Atlanta and a couple of other cities, it doesn't fit either the machine or reform model. We're seeing something that we haven't, that we don't have real categories for, so we're sort of playing with something else here. And for at the moment, let me call what it is we're playing with status reform, although it's not clear to me that that communicates what I want to communicate. But let me play with the category for a minute. There really is, with some of these people, particularly the black leadership that comes out of the civil rights movement, a core value that is neither loyalty nor efficiency. That is much closer to something that we might just call fairness, that has some sort of notion of equal opportunity, right? Of at least access to the bargaining table at the core of it, right? At least opening up the possibility that folks who never got in the front door will get in the front door to talk about what it is they want. There's some kind of fairness ethic I find in some black political figures, particularly out of the civil rights movement, that I don't find anyplace else in city government. When you're thinking about the question of what the organizational analog might be to what we're seeing, what I experienced over and over again is in the Washington campaign, which is one of the most exciting 6 months of my life, is a series of experiences that reminded me very much of the South in the early and mid-60s in the Civil Rights Movement. And I really do think that there's something about whatever it is we're seeing in the politics and government there that calls to mind an organizational analog, which is basically the black church. That is, it's clearly not, whatever we're seeing, clearly is broader than a men's club with the value of loyalty. And it is clearly nowhere near as rational as a corporation, that is an awful lot of feeling tone. Something's going on with the rhetoric of politics in black America that is much closer to the black church. It was never clear in the Washington campaign for mayor when it was you were listening to the prayer at the beginning of a rally, of a political rally, and when it was you were listening to the first political speech, right? I mean, the two sort of just blended into each other, as they will in the rhetoric of black America. There was constant disorganization, if your blinders are the blinders of these categories, constantly disorganized kind of chaos in the campaign, and to some degree in the administration itself. At least there's a tolerance, there is more of a tolerance, and even to some degree a value placed on on allowing things to remain so shaken up that surprises happen all the time. Think about that. And also some faith stuff going on. clearly some faith and some ritual stuff going on that remind people a lot of the Black church. People in who got involved in the Washington campaign, and I've heard the same thing from others, recent Black campaigns, who come out of the secular left with no church background, find themselves incredibly uncomfortable, right, with all this church stuff, with all this singing at the political stuff. The major constituency in the status reform model is clearly the Black middle class attempting to connect with the Black underclass. And this, it seems to me, in terms of the power dynamics of what's going on here, is the key to it. What is different between, when you compare a Washington in Chicago or an Atlanta scene with some of the other Black mayors, a Green in Philadelphia or a Los Angeles, a Bradley in Los Angeles, is that there is a conscious effort to reconnect the disconnected Black middle class with the Black underclass. There is a conscious effort to involve the Black underclass in a new sense of possibilities for its own connection to some mainstream power potentials. Right? You can't do that, it turns out, with a colorblind Black candidate. So come back to the function of race consciousness on the part of these candidates. If Washington had not been very much at home with his Blackness and willing to trumpet it, which of course at the same time sends a lot of white folks scurvy, right, and scares them. But if he had not been at home with that, it's clear that nothing like the amazing mobilization of the Black underclass that happened, at least in the voting patterns in Chicago, where 80% registered in many communities, and 90% of those 80% that registered actually voted, which is just astounding for communities, those of you who know voting statistics. That shows a degree of hope in the possibility of something new happening that just wasn't there and isn't there in most underclass communities. And I'm arguing here that that wouldn't happen without race-conscious candidacy and some combination of this status reform stuff. I'm not sure about this characteristic transaction, what the difference is here, the deal, the plan. There certainly is some the characteristic feel. You sometimes feel like you're in the middle of a set of deals, or you feel like you're in the middle of a set of plans if you're in a new reform mayor's office. You feel, even in the administration in Chicago right now, when you're in City Hall, you feel like you're inside a movement. It feels like a movement still, even though it's trying to run government. So that's a little bit apples and oranges, but I want to get some kind of a feel for what else it might feel like in there. Well, that's enough of that at that stuff. Obviously, I am intrigued by and made somewhat hopeful by my experience in this set of possibilities. I don't know how much that experience, how much sense I've been able to make of it, and B, how replicable it is, how possible it is for such a combination of things to happen elsewhere. I do know, though, that it's the only time in the last 6 or 8 years, at any rate, where I have felt any possibility of reconnecting the growing underclass with the mainstream of the society. It's the only time I have felt that possibility. And since it's my belief that the major issue of social justice in the United States is that underclass, I have to take very seriously the experience of that period. Something did happen that was more or less unique in the politics of Chicago, and we are trying now in Chicago to make it happen in the policies, in the governmental policies of Chicago as well. We can talk about that some. clearly, whatever we want to do about social justice issues in cities particularly can't be done only through city government and politics. It needs a lot of effort on the part of the private sector and voluntary sector, churches. And I think it needs a lot of effort on the part of the federal government, too. I think cities will probably survive the Reagan era, but they will be a lot less healthy than they were, and their rebuilding will take a lot longer than it would have. But it does seem to me that city politics, led and defined by black folks and Hispanics, is a start in the direction of addressing the core questions. And in fact, it's one of the most hopeful developments for me in contemporary America. Let me stop there. Let's see what we can we talk for a little bit about this or anything else? Let me just, while you're thinking about it, let's do talk. I mean, I think there's lots to talk about. I feel like I've just sort of skimmed the surface here. But let me point out that the bookstore has a number of copies of the book, a recent Brookings Institution book edited by Paul Peterson, which is probably the best collection of stuff that's current that deals at all up front with the underclass question. It's a little bit too technologically oriented for my taste. It was actually ordered by Al Pitcher from the University of Chicago, who was up here earlier in the summer. But I think it's okay, and I think that if you're interested in reading some further stuff, particularly on the problem of the underclass, and its intractability, these people are not very hopeful about the immediate future for American cities. That's probably worth looking at. There are not very many good current collections of stuff on American cities. It's not an in thing to be studying and writing about. Thought I'd give that little plug, friends at the bookstore.
Maybe my question will not touch directly the question about social justice in the city, but in Latin America, we also experience that, you know, the working class, the underclass, is now beginning to have hopes, and they are organizing themselves and trying to start new political parties, these new methodologies how to run a political party. And during this 1 year and a half that we are here, we couldn't see if this is also happening here. What we are experiencing is that even people who are in the underclass and are suffering, they are putting their hopes in the traditional party that exists. They are not trying to do something new. They are using the old structure, modifying a little bit, but trying to, I don't know, if you, in your experience.
Yeah, I think that's right, Jamal. I think that, although I think it depends on what you want to define as your core question there. If your core question is there something analogous in the United States among poor people that is evidence of initiative, is evidence of some kind of playing out of hope in the public sector? If that's the question, then I think the answer is clearly yes. There are lots of evidences that I'm going to probably be talking about mostly Friday, of some interesting bottom-up kinds of organizing and development efforts in American cities. Now, none of those efforts, all that I know of, none of the serious efforts take the form of a political party. And that has to do, I think, with the kind of political history we're dealing with in the United States. They're just the fate of third parties here has not been a very successful one, ever. And certainly not in the last 50 years. And the loyalties of black folks from the 1930s on, from the New Deal years on, have been intimately intertwined with the Democratic Party here. And because we have basically non-ideological political parties here, right, there may be enough room in something that's as jello-like as the Democratic Party, right, that's got room for virtually everybody under its umbrella anyway, there may be enough room for activity of a political nature even under that umbrella that would be very much like what's going on in Brazil. But the other way to go at that question is to talk some about what the Jesse Jackson phenomenon means. I mean, that's a your question would be right at home in a discussion with Jesse and his major advisors these days. That's what he's thinking about. I don't know if we want to do that.
One of the things that it seems to me from my connections with the city is that as far as the church's role or connection with this whole process, that one of the problems is that the people that often are that we're choosing from the political people that finally rise to the top, that really you don't really have some of your best people running for office. And that some of the ones that are running and are getting elected are in many ways not the kind of people that really have any great sympathy or interest in the so-called underclass. Mm-hmm. And I guess I see, even though it's a very tiny infinitesimal role that the church can make, but unless some of our people are willing to be used and to be encouraged.
Be used is an interesting way to phrase it.
You know, it just nothing. I mean, I'm just not sure what our contribution can be except as a caring institution within that community or what. Even for example, in the black community, I don't know how it is in Chicago. But as I see in the black community often, some of the best black people are not running for political office and cannot be made to run for political office. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens, as far as I'm concerned, in the white community too. You know, that somehow within the psychology of our, or in the way in which we operate in the United States, that the people that might have a real interest in changing things will never get their names at the head of the ballot when the whole thing is over, unless there's some changes going on somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's more ruminations than anything else. But just a comment about that: how are you going to have social justice if the people that we are elected are basically so tied into the system that they won't, all they're going to do is tinker with the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that there's no real interest in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That maybe that's more dismay than anything else. But how can you have social justice without people of character and of depth and of compassion?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how, you know, no matter, you can run any kind of system you want to, but if there's no compassionate, no interested, no caring individuals, I don't mean that they have to be incompetent either, but there's a lot of competent people around that are simply uninterested in the political
sure.
aspects of the world in which we live.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the public, it seems to me that, I mean, you're pointing to a huge set of problems for the United States, it seems to me. And my favorite book these days is Habits of the Heart, which, among other things, is a lament about the shrinking of public space in the United States, the privatization of virtually everything, the view that, in this instance, for instance, political life is nothing more than a hustle like any other corporate ladder, you know, that you climb up, and that basically what you're in there for is self-interest, I believe strongly in self-interest, and I think probably everybody works off that to some degree or other. The reason that I have stayed close in touch with black politics is that it seems to me that in some instances, black politics is an exception in the United States. You still have political leaders who are connected, oftentimes, directly to a constituency, and whose will, constituency's will, those leaders carry forward. You know? Harold Washington did not want to run for mayor of Chicago. He absolutely didn't want to. He had finally made it to Congress, and that was his life's ambition. He was a hell of a legislator. He loved doing it. He was a great negotiator. He was absolutely in his element. He had never administered an office that was bigger than 8 people, you know. The last thing in the world he wanted to do was to get into the dirty, racial, street politics of Chicago and run for mayor. The black community literally forced him to do that. Just pressured him to do that. Now, in white politics, you very seldom see anymore that close kind of relationship between a leader and a constituency where you can identify a voice, no matter whether you agree with it or not, a voice of some, you know, identifiable group that a leader speaks for. In the black community, you still can, and there are real advantages to that in terms of keeping a guy honest, or a woman honest, whoever the candidate is. You never sort of can get too far removed from at least an aroused black constituency. You can, I think, in a lot of white areas, as long as you sort of deliver on whatever the major interest groups are in the white area. So I think it's a little bit different. And that's why, in terms of social justice, it's why I'm particularly interested in black politics and Hispanic politics.
What would white women or women churches' responses to what's going on?
Well, it's interesting. It got, you know, I suppose some of you, the election in Chicago got racially really hot. And the mainline white churches, while not, Chicago is the largest archdiocese in the world. Right? So it's really the Catholic Church, despite the fact that the National Lutheran Body will now be in Chicago. Chicago will still be a Catholic town. The organized Catholic Church, and then we did some work with the Lutherans, all were very clear in denouncing the overt kind of racism that came up in the campaign. And a good many of the clergy in serving congregations in white areas in Chicago used the opportunity of the campaign to deal with their congregation's fears. Had some very volatile meetings and sessions on race and on racial fears and racism. So there were, I would say, by the mainstream churches and by the clergy of the mainstream white churches, there were more creative and involved people and responses than I expected. Yeah, there really were. The churches were the one place you thought you could go in a white community and wear a Washington button, you know, and not get spat on or something, or at least you could talk with people. And where Washington himself could go and mostly get a civil reception, although not entirely.
There's more kind of growing money kind of time for the churches in Chicago at that time.
Yeah, and there's still an adjustment to it. I mean, you know, the other reason to be interested in this story, it seems to me, is that it's an adjustment that all of us as Americans are going to have to go through. You know, all of the projections say that in something like 70 years, white European-rooted Americans will be a minority in the United States. Right? And we clearly are that when we think about ourselves globally, right? So unless we can really have the experience of living multiculturally and multiracially and sharing power, I think we're in big trouble. So partly Chicago has been that sort of laboratory. And in fact, in some church settings, it's been possible to say something like that and get people thinking about it a little bit and not you know, the massive white flight that people predicted that Washington were elected simply didn't happen. Three and a half years. We're going for a second election.
Or 57.
Some, although we haven't had control, I will now use the we. We haven't had control of the city council, so we haven't been able to get a lot of the legislative stuff through that we wanted to. We now, if we win a second term, we will. And that's an exciting prospect. I haven't talked at all today about the sort of policy directions that it seems to me possible for cities to go in. I might do that a little bit in the next couple of days. Another thing to say about the church is that, you know, I'm constantly, I mean, I think it's been true for centuries, but I certainly was re-amazed this time through at the incredible resiliency and resources that are resident in the black church. And it is just a different animal, isn't it, from the white church. There is not that clear split between private religion, you know, and public life that so much of the white church has. I mean, there just isn't that split. And, black preachers in black communities are still the power base to deal with if you want to get to the folks. There are a few other bases to deal with, but just simply from the point of view of political power, you cannot ignore the black church. I think you can ignore the white church. Lots of areas and get somebody elected. But you can't do it in the black community or the black church.
Has that been constant? Do you think that what you see in the black church in terms of progress or whatever, when you look at these different stages of kinds of say, in the last 20 years, you've cited some contrast between the past and present. Does that black church remain constant, say, since the 60s?
Well, some parts of it do, Eunice. I think, but large segments of the black church in Chicago, and it's not any different there than elsewhere, were in fact bought off by the machine. Right? I mean, literally bought off. That is, the machine would give, local ward organization would give a pastor $5,000 a year. Or, you know, would allow the requisite permits and so forth to go through smoothly. And cause trouble for that church if they didn't toe the line. So an awful lot of the older, particularly the older black clergy, were right in the pocket of the old machine. And for them, it was a huge turnaround to think about themselves as black independents politically. But they did it. They did it, and their folks dragged them into it.
And as some of the same population has gone through the different forms, should we say, the old black clergy, a turnaround. Some of those are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And manage the transition.
Yes. Yes.
Still functioning as the new.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any difference, though, in terms of social justice, if the schools aren't any better, if the facilities aren't any better, if the crime rate is still the same, if there are still masses of street people that aren't being fed? I mean, I guess when I think of social justice, I think of those kinds of issues being, you know, if the quality of the life in the city is not, I don't think it just stays the same in terms, by its nature, things run down rather than, as we get older, our bodies run down, and so do the city. So there has to be some impacts made by the system. And when you think of schools in the cities, when you think of law enforcement, drug trafficking, crime, the justice system, all of those kinds of things to me are really up for grabs in the city these days.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple times today that I think that this is a limited hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really do think, when I think about it in an overall sense, I don't see any option. If we're gonna pile up poor people in cities, I mean, somehow a larger jurisdiction has responsibility for that pile-up, right? And I think probably a state is, and the uneven distribution would be a problem there. And I think probably only the federal government can do it, and that's an awfully unpopular thing to say these days, but I don't see any option to it.
Or if that's the only option that's available to us in the cities these days, is money, and which we're not going to get anyway, you know, I mean, if that's the only option, then, I mean, maybe we have to be thinking of some other options, because...
I think there are some interim things to do that I'm going to talk about in the next couple of days in the social and cultural realm. I'm a decentralist at heart, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about some local, very, very local kinds of options, including some stuff that local congregations are doing in the next couple of days.
I think there are congregations that are doing things.
Absolutely.
Things, you know.
Absolutely.